Control room just gave me the thumbs up. We must be all set. Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday. It's the 26th of October and a week and a day away from Election Day. And here we are. We have a lot to talk about. We have wonderful people to do it with. And we'll make it through the week again. Here we go. It's rainy. It feels weird. But we'll make it through. I know we will. We'll all be together. We'll talk about stuff. We'll try to make sense of it. Here we go. WAMC's Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Well, as the Yiddish expression goes, I'm sitting on shpilkas. And what that means is, pins and needles.
I think that's most of our panelists probably know, but yes, go ahead. For the rest of the audience,
that's what I'm sitting on. You know, at one point or another, you probably ought to get a psychiatrist of note to come in and talk about the amount of anxiety that exists in this population. It's huge. Everywhere I go, people are telling me they can't sleep, they can't this, they can't that, you know, and I think I get it. I do get it. I'm experiencing some of that myself.
It is, yes, it is definitely a thing, and which is why it's nice that we have this opportunity to all get together and talk about stuff and try to make whatever sense we can make out of it. Political consultant Libby Post is with us. Good morning, Libby. How are ya?
I'm fine. I've got a little spilkus too, but I'm managing. I'm
that's
sleeping.
All right.
That's why I take Tylenol PM at night so I can sleep.
Oh, that helps. You're not supposed to, according to the sleep doctors, but you know.
Yeah, well, life goes on.
Any port in a storm. Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, the director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Handler. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Morning, Joe. I'm good. You know, it's funny. One of the little known facts of my life is once upon a time, I actually got a psych degree in Texas. I'm actually able to practice psychology in Texas. Maybe we should just turn this into the morning psychologies section. I can do the Dr. Phil thing or something.
How many doctorates do you have,
Jim? I wish I could. That's not a doctorate.
Oh, okay.
Masters, but yeah.
Masters.
No, I only have one doctorate.
Okay.
Four or five masters on the way. Took me a long time
off
to decide what I wanted to be when I grew up.
That's all right.
Indecision.
Immigration attorney and associate of the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert. Good morning, Sienna. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I'm good.
Wonderful.
I'm surviving.
Good. Good. Wonderful to have you aboard. I thank you very much. And we also are very happy to have our in-house immunologist, Dr. Jim Fagan. He is an immunologist whose specialty is in pediatric immunology. He's been with us for the last several weeks as we've talked about various states of COVID and the president's condition and now just overall numbers and what we're going through. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Fagan back to the program for a little bit this morning. Good morning, Dr. Fagan. How are you?
Good morning. It's nice to be back. And I think I agree with Alan. It might be more appropriate to have a psychiatrist than an immunologist these days, but we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, well, we may just have, if you know one, well, let us know. We'll put them on call and we'll bring them in whenever they can do it.
But you know, from an immunology point of view, Joe, Dr. Fagan might be able to advise us as to how crazy it is, or not.
Yeah.
How crazy it is that the you get this guy, Pence, who's now running around. I mean, this is a guy who could hardly move. He looked sort of toad-like. And now he's running in and, you know, running in and pointing out into the audience and doing all those, you know, political things. But in any case, he has refused, Jim, to quarantine himself, even though several, not one, but several people on his staff who he regularly dealt with have come down with the COVID.
And meanwhile, back at the ranch, Mark Meadows was on State of the Nation with Jake Tapper and said, we are not going to bring the virus under control. and basically said, okay, we give up. I mean, I think I don't, I know that's probably politically a biased statement, but it, right? If you just say we're not going to get it under control, we're going to let it run its course like the flu, that means you're not going to do anything about it, right?
Well, you know, I think it's mind-boggling why the chief of staff to the president of the United States would publicly state that the COVID-19 pandemic cannot be controlled. I mean, it defies science and completely ignores what actually happened in many states in this country, such as New York, when people listened and did what was needed and got the pandemic under control. I mean, remember what happened in New York. It really is a question of leadership and role modeling. It just boggles my mind how that statement could have been made. I mean, we live in a country where there are over 8,500,000 cases with 225,000 deaths. Just yesterday, there were 82,000 new cases reported. I mean, this infection is not going away. We're not turning a corner. And it is absolutely imperative that we listen to what the scientists are telling us. This pandemic can be controlled, and it involves wearing a mask wherever you go, outside or indoors. You cannot, and even if you can exercise social distancing, that doesn't mean you don't have to wear a mask. Hand washing, hand hygiene, I mean, these are the things that we need to pay attention to.
The other thing to Alan's point and original question about Mike Pence, so you have most of your inner circle testing positive. He continues to go out on the trail. That is consistent with what Meadows said of, all right, we're not going to control it. Just go on with your lives.
Well, you have to remember, you can be contagious 2 or 3 days before you develop symptoms. And I don't know how often he's getting tested. Tests are not 100% accurate, but there is no question that with the close contact that the vice president had with Mark Short would require quarantining for 14 days.
I think. Go ahead, Alan.
And very quickly, then, Jim. And now we have the president who says the reason we have so much reported stuff is because we test too much. It's
an old standby line.
Yeah, I don't even know what to say to that.
But
one.
He's still using it.
Still using it.
He's
That's
the
right.
president of the United States.
Well, and the other thing too about that is this failure to on I believe it was on Friday night said. During one of his rallies, COVID, COVID, COVID. That's all you hear about when you turn on television, COVID, COVID, COVID. After November 4th, you're not going to hear about it anymore. Well, that's frightening.
Well, you know, also, I mean, they're relying on the vaccine, which they claim is around the corner, which we all know that's not true. They may make some major announcements in a couple of weeks with regard to the results of phase 3 clinical trials. You know, we know that there are at least 4 pharmaceutical companies who are actively engaged in developing a vaccine, and I have no doubt that there will be a vaccine. But then it's going to be, you know, quite a while before, you know, this vaccine is distributed and a sufficient number of Americans are vaccinated, which will, you know, lower the, you know, the infectious threshold and get us into a position where we want to be in. But it's going to be a matter of time. The fact that Mark Meadows also said that the way to deal with this virus is not to control it, but to develop vaccines and better you know, therapeutic modalities
right.
for this. I mean, it's just, again, it's mind-boggling. I mean, the analogy that I think of is, well, we know that cigarette smoking causes lung cancer, and so perhaps the best way to manage lung cancer would not be to encourage people to quit smoking, but maybe just to develop better chemotherapy. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, obviously, we want to control and contain this virus.
So even if that were a play in the playbook, we know it's not, but even if it were, then why not do it? Why didn't you do it in March? I mean, instead of just let it go, because they didn't do anything. And that's what I don't understand is you're saying, oh, well, now we're going to deal with it this way while we have some of the highest numbers we've had. We're worse now than we've been at the height of the virus in March and again in August.
And it's going up.
Right. It could be six figures by the time. By the end of the week, many experts, such as yourself, I'm not saying that you agree with this, but many experts in immunology say that could very well be the case.
Very well. I mean, it's doing the math.
And while we're on the subject, just for a few sentences, you should tell us about the danger of, flu at the same time as we have the COVID.
Right.
Well, you know, influenza, you know, has been with us for forever, and we know that there are many, many people who succumb to the flu. The flu is different than COVID-19. It's not nearly as contagious as COVID-19 is, and there certainly are many, many Americans who are vulnerable, you know, to the flu, and the people at risk are probably the same people who are at risk for complications of COVID-19. But COVID-19 has a number of other features that the flu doesn't have, including this long-term symptoms that develop in a significant number of people. This is called long COVID. This is something that, you know, we're learning more and more about. You don't generally see that with influenza. So these are individuals who are complaining of, you know, generalized, you know, fatigue and weakness and aches and pains, and some are having prolonged respiratory symptoms. This is something unique, I think, to COVID-19, and we're, you know, in the process of learning more and more about, you know, this particular virus and long-term sequelae from this virus. So I think that, you know, you can't, you know, the COVID-19 is absolutely very different than influenza. Influenza can be lethal. We've had horrible experiences with influenza. We do, thank goodness, have a vaccine for influenza. The vaccine is not 100% effective. Actually, that flu vaccine is developed on another mathematical model that predicts how the influenza virus will mutate, because they actually have to make the vaccine before next year's influenza, you know, actually emerges. And sometimes they're right. Most of the time they are. But sometimes they're off. And we know that the vaccine doesn't work. So there, again, it just points out the fact that there are issues and problems with vaccinations. But the having influenza emerge and add that to what's going on with the COVID-19 pandemic, what that is going to do to our medical facilities is, I don't even want to think about that.
So the state that we're hearing that's having the biggest problem right now is Indiana, and the am I right on that? Is it Illinois or Indiana? I believe it's Indiana. I'll check that.
Which, by the way, is Mike Pence's home state?
Yes.
Just saying.
Yeah, so they're saying that the. The concern is about the hospitals and that they don't know what they're going to do because they're already full. And obviously we've seen this in New York, but as you get into more rural areas, and we are finding that this virus is now surging in more rural areas, who don't have enough hospital beds probably to begin with, what do you do?
I don't know. I mean, those patients will obviously have to be transported to major medical facilities, which will quickly be just overwhelmed They're not going to have the room. They don't have the hospital beds. They don't have the ICU beds. They don't have the ventilators. They don't have enough PPEs. There's going to have to be some horrible decisions that will have to be made regarding, you know, who's viable, who isn't. It's just I don't want to think about what that's going to be like.
And it was Illinois. It was Illinois, the Illinois director of Department of Public Health, who broke down in tears Friday when talking about this, because she doesn't know what to do. There's no help from the federal government. The state's doing what they can, and yet there are emergency rooms, and of course they have the city of Chicago on top of it. So it's a very difficult issue. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have our wonderful panel with us. We'll hear from them as well. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Jim Henler, and Sienna Freeman Tolbert. Immunologist Dr. Jim Fagan is our special guest for another half hour or so, and we thank him for being with us. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will continue our conversation and include your letters right after this short break. Good Monday morning to you. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Jim Henler, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, and Dr. Jim Fagan. We also welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We got this letter from Hani for Dr. Fagan, who says, should we get a whole house HEPA filter?
It is unclear whether or not. Well, first of all, there are different types of HEPA filters, and the HEPA filters may not be sufficient to filter out viral particles, which are exceptionally small. The other thing is that we know that the COVID-19 becomes aerosolized, which means it's sort of floating through the air. And some of that, of course, if you do have a filter, will be sucked in and into the filter and, maybe taken out. I don't think that at this point I would recommend that everyone run out and get a HEPA filter.
We also got this from Dan, who says, I was wondering, as I listened to your discussion this morning about the soon-to-be-released vaccine, if you could have Dr. Fagan comment on whether or not immunity is likely to be achieved. I've read that multiple people have contracted COVID-19 twice, casting some doubt on whether or not a vaccine will actually be effective.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good and important question, and we don't know the answer to that. Time will tell and inform us how long the immunity is to this virus. Having had experience with other coronaviruses, I would think that the immunity to COVID-19, if you actually contract this illness, this infection, I would think that you would have fairly long-lasting immunity. But you always have to remember that everyone's different and their immune systems are different. And I would like to learn a little bit more about those individuals who reportedly contracted COVID-19 twice. These are individuals, and there are a number of reports. These are people who were diagnosed, had a positive test, they had the illness, they were sick, they recovered, they got tested again, their test was negative, and then weeks or months later, they became positive again, and some of them got sick again, which would clearly suggest that they did not have a long-lasting immune response to COVID-19. Now, what I would, as an immunologist, what I would be interested in looking at their immune responses. Are these individuals who may, unbeknownst to them, have a defect, some sort of immune deficiency that renders them unduly susceptible or that in some way interferes with what would be a normal immune response? We need to learn a lot more about that. We do know that, based on numbers, the vast majority of individuals who contract COVID-19 appear not to get it again, appear to be immune. And the question is, how long will that immunity last? And then, that sort of directs our attention to how long will the immunity last from a vaccine. I mean, nothing is more stimulating to the immune system than the natural infection. I don't think, the vaccines are directed against specific parts of the virus, which the virus needs in order to attach to the human cell and get into the cell. Remember, if the virus doesn't get into the cell, it dies because the virus has to replicate. It's got to divide. It's got to reproduce. And the only way it can do that is by taking over the DNA of the host cell. So it's got to get into the cell. And if you block that entry, then that infection is not going to take place. And so the vaccines are sort of they're directed against some of those spikes on the surface of the virus that enable them to get into the cell. And so, you know, hopefully the vaccine, you know, once it comes out, will have long-lasting immunity. But that's the phase four of the clinical trial.
Right.
You know, it is what happens 6 months, a year, 2 years down the road, you know, to these individuals. And we're going to have to wait that one out.
Jim, can I ask a question? One of the questions I'm asked a lot, and I don't know because I'm not that kind of doctor, is this more likely to be like a flu vaccine where you'll have to get it every year?
Yeah.
Or more likely to be like the, you know, measles, mumps, something like that, where it's going to be once for a very long time?
Right. So the likelihood is that you will not need to get this on an annual basis. The reason that we need to get a flu vaccine every year is because influenza is a very smart virus. It has learned how to mutate, and it mutates to avoid human immune responses. And so it changes its structure a little bit, and so that the influenza virus that we encountered last year is not the same influenza that we're going to be encountering this year, which is why you have to get a new flu vaccine every year. It's, I think, unlikely, based on what we know so far, that COVID-19 is going to mutate that way. Now all viruses mutate, so it may mutate in certain ways, but we're hoping that the way that COVID-19 mutates is not by changing the outer structure. And if it doesn't change the outer structure, and we have vaccines that are directed to generate antibodies against that outer structure, then they should be effective, and should be effective, hopefully, you know, for if not lifelong, for many, many years. So, but we're going to have to wait and see.
Any other panel members with a question for Dr. Fagan?
I have a fast one, Joe, if I may, and that is, I understand, Jim, that you have to have two shots, not one. Is that right?
Well, for a couple of the vaccines, there are you know, four companies working on the vaccinations right now: Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, and at least one or two of them, I think, require two vaccinations a month apart. You know, and there are other, you know, which is obviously going to be a real issue in terms of getting that vaccine out, getting, you know, everyone in this country, you know, vaccinated, and getting them back for the second vaccine. Obviously, that poses tremendous problems. But I think there's at least one that does not require two injections.
That's a fascinating point, because I know just from the shingles vaccine, which is two injections, sometimes
right.
They have the first one, they don't have the second one, or vice versa. And and I mean, that can really be an issue, because it's like, well, we're not going to give you this one because we may not get the other one for another 6 months.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right, Joe. I mean, that's exactly what happened with Shingrix. I mean, that's a great vaccine for, you know, for shingles. And the recommendation is you get vaccinated, and then 6 months later you come back and you get your second injection.
Right.
Problem was, when it first came out, there were issues, and you couldn't get the second injection, and you couldn't get it for months. You know, and so I would hope that would not happen with a new COVID-19 vaccine, but we'll have to wait on that one too. You're right.
We go to Joyce, who says, my daughter has two girls, ages 6 and 8. The 6-year-old has type 1 diabetes. All of the neighbor kids are all out playing together outside, but my daughter's girls are not allowed to play with them due to the 6-year-old's condition. What is your feeling of kids playing outside together now, and is my daughter doing the right thing?
Well, I think, you know, it's just so hard to deal with these kids. And you know, it's so important for them, you know, to engage in social activities. And you know, it's absolutely essential for their health, their growth, their development. But I think that, you know, we can compromise a little bit. And I think if her daughter was wearing a face mask, I certainly would encourage that. And she's outside, and you know, she is taught certain, you know, social distancing kinds of things, which is really hard in, you know, 6 year olds who are playing with their friends. But they can be taught how to do this, and I think that would be fine if she were careful and absolutely wearing a mask. And when she came inside, you know, she, you know, takes her mask off and washes her hands, washes her face, and, you know, stuff like that. I think that would be fine.
We also have this one, which is from Howard. My understanding is that when vaccines are available, scientists say that they will be 60-70% effective, and therefore will we still require masks and social distancing? Is that true? What will America do?
Yeah.
Ah, the big question. What will America do?
Yeah, what will America do? You know, it brings up the issue of herd immunity, because if 70% of the country is immune to this virus, then that will establish herd immunity and will make it much, much, much less likely that you're going to go out and contract COVID-19 by doing your normal activities, going to the store, going to work, you know, taking public transportation. Nothing is 100%. You know, there's no absolute guarantee. And there may be individuals who have pre-existing conditions who would be advised to continue to be careful and continue to wear a mask when outside, and to exercise social distancing as best as possible. But I think that if we got 70% of the country vaccinated and the vaccine was demonstrated to be safe and effective, I think that would dramatically change things in the United States.
We have to go to a break. Dr. Fagan, I want to thank you very much for being with us and spending time with us this morning and giving us information that seems rather scarce these days. And I so appreciate you spending time with us today and all the times that you do.
It's my pleasure, Joe. Thank you.
Be well. Thank you. When we come back, we'll continue with our panel. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Jim Henler, Sienna Freeman Tolbert. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. So we've been talking about the medical aspect of this. I'd like to turn and talk about the political aspect of this. Mark Meadows on CNN State of the Union yesterday saying, we're not going to control the pandemic. We are going to control the fact that we get vaccines, therapeutics, and other mitigations. Joe Biden, who was out on the trail yesterday, said this wasn't a slip by Meadows. It was a candid acknowledgement of what President Trump's strategy has clearly been from the beginning of the crisis, to wave the white flag of defeat and hope that by ignoring it, the virus would simply go away. It hasn't, and it won't. Actually, he made that in a statement yesterday following the remarks of Mark Meadows. Alan, if you're running against President Trump and you're Joe Biden, I mean, you have to look at that as something that obviously you can run on.
Well, the thing that most of us can't understand is how so many people can be so stupid, you know, and ingest that stuff. I mean, you see these crowds out there, you know, that he's put together. He's not wearing a mask. And for the most part, neither are they. And they're getting sick. So what are we dealing with here? Libby, maybe you have an idea. Locusts? What is it that gets in? what gets into their brains?
Right.
What'd you say?
With all due respect to lemmings, they're lemmings. I mean, they just follow this guy, do whatever he says, because he hates the same people they hate. And I know people are sick and tired of me saying this, but that's really the motivation here. And when Mark Meadows says, we're going to control the facts, I think he should have just stopped there. Because that's really what this is about.
Jim,
this is about.
So, you know, I think there's something, I kind of started to think yesterday that something different is going on than just this lemming thing. So I was driving, it was a nice day and I wanted to see leaves. So my wife and I drove to our place in West Stockbridge, up through Pittsfield, back into New York Day through North Lebanon. You know, what was interesting was seeing the number of Biden signs in Western Massachusetts. But then when we came into New York, we were seeing a lot of Trump signs and a lot of Delgado signs, often in the same lawn.
Mm.
Right. So politically, something different is going on than just, you know, I believe this or I believe that. It's somehow become much more cults of personality and, you know, where I can see things that impact me directly versus things that seem to be, you know, affecting the other millions of people in the country, but not me. I mean, there's something going on that's different than just Trumpism. I don't know what it is, but it's very strange.
How do you feel about this idea? Those people, and I'm still smacking myself on the side of my head, saying, how can these people be doing this, ignoring the facts, ignoring the science? And I'm saying, you know, one of the worst wars Americans have ever been in was the Civil War. And I think, historically, what we have here is what's left over generationally from the Civil War. That's who these people are.
I think you're absolutely right.
The other thing I don't quite understand, and I know that none of this makes sense. I mean, I've gotten the last 3.5 years has taught me anything. It's that none of this makes any sense. But it does seem, if there is such a thing as a undecided voter, that to go, as the president did, to go into Wisconsin, and to go into a state that is, I think, the worst in the nation as far as numbers right now, it is the hot spot. And to hold a rally against the advice of every health official, not only in Wisconsin, but in the entire country, and to know that, yes, this could be another super spreader event, which I don't even know if that means anything to anybody anymore, but it should. And if doesn't it, for even the people in Wisconsin as a swing state, does it help you win the state to say, we're going in, we're having a rally, to hell with the virus, come along with us?
See, my understanding is that he is losing some support in some battleground states like Florida and Pennsylvania, which have the oldest populations, because I'm understanding that the seniors are, you know, not supporting Trump as much in those states. So I think it is impacting him in some way. I think that people are concerned about their health, and hearing Meadows say that they're just, you know, there's nothing they can do about it at this time, basically, I think that does affect some of these voters. The children are taking care of people who are, you know, affected by COVID. So I think there is, you know, it may not be, you know, we still see them at the rallies, but I still think, I think he is losing support with this.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I just want to argue that for a minute. The raw numbers, the percentages of Americans who are still supporting this guy remain steady. Now, you're right. You're absolutely right that in some states where he won, he's now losing. At least we think he's losing, and there's that.
True.
But, you know, this group won't move off the dime. They won't. They wear that. It reminds me so much of I'll get letters on this, the Hitler rallies, where these people just, you know, applauded and cried and got weak at the knees and you know, it is, I can't see that there's been major damage to his core base. And what he's counting on and has been counting on since day one is if you get every one of those people out there, you'll win.
Turnout. Yep.
Yeah. Jim?
Well, and turnout, and now I suspect turnout on election day, especially with the court change. But you know, what he is hoping is that his people will ignore coronavirus, go out and vote at their polling place on their day. And since many of them live in rural counties where they won't have to wait in huge long lines and won't have the voter suppression against them, you know, if he can, if he looks good on election night, I think we're going to see all hell break out for the next couple months. And so, you know, I mean, again, it's going to be a really spookus.
Yeah. Webby, did
I
you
go back to,
go ahead.
Can I go back to Sienna just for a second?
Mm-hmm.
And say, you know, a number of people have been coming up to me and saying, you know, I love Joe Biden and I think he's a good man, but he is not the kind of iconic, you know, person who can deal with crowds the way that Trump can. Now, am I a Trumper? I don't think anybody thinks I am. Nevertheless, I think there's something there. If you compare Trump, for example, to Hitler, you will see that he does those things in order to attract those people, and they're there for him. And I'm sorry for monopolizing it.
No, I think it's go ahead, Libby.
You're absolutely right, Alan. You know, Trump's rallies are like Hitler rallies. There's no two ways about it. They are just mesmerized and will say yes to anything that he has to say. But, you know, it was interesting. I always look at Clear Politics, and Frank Luntz this morning had I think he did an interview or something. He said if they're wrong this time around and Trump wins, that's the end of the polling industry. But if they're right, which I think they might be, this is a different time. It's a different candidate. It's not Hillary. 4 years of Trump has had an impact. COVID has had an impact. Biden's ahead in Wisconsin by 9, in Michigan by 10, in Pennsylvania by 8. Yeah. And that's a U of Wisconsin, YouGov poll.
Florida?
Florida's like 2 points.
A little bit in Florida.
Florida scares the hell out of me.
What I saw this morning, he was ahead in a couple of polls and behind in a couple of polls. In the CBS News, YouGov, he was from yesterday. He was up by 2, and then he was up by 2.
Real clear politics. Yes, so clear I can say it. Florida, Biden is up 1.5. North Carolina, Biden is up by 1. Wisconsin up by 5.5, and in Pennsylvania up by 5. Trump leading in Georgia and Ohio by very slim margins, we should note, which I read this morning that Biden is headed to Georgia for obvious reasons. Sienna, I remember go ahead.
Yeah. Well, no, it's just that right now I'm looking at Real Clear Politics for Monday today. Georgia, Biden's up by 1.
Yeah.
He's going back and forth and back and forth. So, and then you have this other race in Georgia that also is quite, you know, people are just saying that Georgia could turn blue. And we'll see what happens in South Carolina, whether or not Jamie Harrison can pull it off against Lindsey Graham and whether Mark Kelly can win in Arizona. I mean, it's really an interesting dynamic. I have this feeling that Trump is, I mean, I watched the 60 Minutes thing last night. He's so arrogant. He's so like, you're wrong, I'm right. That's the end of the conversation. That he's deluding himself as to what the real feelings of the country are. And COVID is not helping. It is not helping him at all.
I would love to talk more about the 60 Minutes interview when we come back, because I want to talk to you all about that. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have a wonderful panel. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Jim Hendler, Sienna Freeman Tolbert. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll take a break. We'll get some news with Ray Graff, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartak, Libby Post, Jim Henler, and Sienna Freeman Tolbert. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. CBS's 60 Minutes on Sunday aired its interviews with both the Democratic and Republican presidential tickets after President Trump walked out of the interview last week, alleging bias by journalist Leslie Stahl. You will recall that then the president, violating an agreement that they had with CBS, released the quote-unquote raw version of the interview on his Facebook feed on Thursday. And then CBS said, well, they were going to continue to run it. And they did last night, trying to get to the bottom of exactly why he walked out. It seems that the reason he walked out is because he got upset over the question. Well, two things, I think. One was one particular question, that a point that Leslie Stahl made is that you don't have as many people at your rallies now as you did before because of COVID, and that made the president really upset. But then then they started to talk about fake news, and the president kept on saying that you give Joe Biden softball after softball. You started with me. Your first statement was, you're ready for tough questions. That's no way to talk. I think we have enough of an interview here before walking out. Came off to me as a little whiny, but what do you think, Libby Post?
A little whiny? How about petulant 3-year-old?
Or that.
I mean, or that. I mean, you know, he was so condescending, I can't say what I want to say. You know, so arrogant, condescending, misogynist, all of the above. And he has his own set of facts, just like Mark Meadows said, yesterday. He has his own set of facts. He refuses to, as we all know, listen to anybody else. And I think Leslie Stahl was trying to be as nice as humanly possible, as open and warm and charming as she is, a complete juxtaposition to Nora O'Donnell. And he still, if you don't do exactly what he wants, if you aren't, you know, subjugating yourself to him, you are wrong, you're mean, you're treating me badly, I'm taking my balls and going home. And, you know, so what? Let him take his balls and go home. The fact of the matter is, he looked like an idiot doing what he did last night.
You know, you mentioned...
He really did. Now, his base will be like, yeah, because it's just the liberal media. But for any thinking person in this country, he looked like a petulant 3-year-old.
And I thought there was a very telling moment where Leslie Stahl looked at him and said, I didn't want it to turn out this way. You know,
right,
I wanted this to
right.
be a conversation. And he said, yes, you did.
Right.
Yes, you did. And she said, no, I didn't.
Yes.
I did. I wanted to talk as people normally can talk. You mentioned Nora O'Donnell. I'm interested in what the panel thinks of her go at this. It struck me as Nora O'Donnell's way of interviewing Joe Biden was to take every Trump talking point as if it were accurate and true, and ask
kidding.
It as a question, as if it were, you know, are you mentally fit? Do you have dementia? What's on your son's laptop? It just seemed odd. Everything that she, but many of the questions that she had were debunked, have long been thought of to be just non-relevant, irrelevant? Yes.
Irrelevant.
And suddenly they're being asked as if they were true because the president has said them on the campaign trail. That, I thought, was an odd way of going.
Either that or giving him questions that he could easily refute and say, are you kidding? I mean, there was that, because he was able to do that. But she did reinforce the Orange Menace's messaging around him. And I just thought she was horrible. I really did.
And the best moment was when Nora O'Donnell asked Kamala Harris if she was a socialist, and Kamala Harris just laughed in her face. That was enjoyable. Jim.
It was priceless.
I can't add anything to that. I agree. You know, I mean, again, it was weird questioning, but you know, I think giving him a chance to respond to them. So far, he's mostly only been able to respond to them in the debate settings where it was, you know, contentious. And here, being able in the quiet to say, look, there's nothing to this, seems to me not to have hurt him. So, you know, I mean, I don't know. It seemed like an interesting technique, but it seemed like it, you know. Made him, you know, someone said on the radio, I wish I could remember who I heard say it, but someone said the other day, can you imagine what it would be like to live in this country again where you could wake up in the morning and the president wouldn't be on the front page?
Right.
This is, you know, this was the Joe Biden we were looking at. It. I wouldn't mind going back to some kind of normality like that.
Does it help him, do you think, Alan, Biden, to come out and to, I mean, he answered mm-hmm. questions about his age, he answered questions about his mental acuity, he answered questions about, there were even some things on policy, believe it or not.
Of course, I mean, he's known as the sort of policy guy. I'd love to hear what Sienna has to say about this, as sitting here and as an impartial observer, which I know she is, Sienna, what do you make of Biden now? Can you separate yourself from, you know, political stuff and just say, okay, who's doing a better job here?
See, so I'm not as impartial as I would like to be, but I really do think that interview with Nora O'Donnell was, you know, it gave him the opportunity, like Jim said, to respond to some of these crazy claims. And I think it needed to be responded to because a lot of people, to go back to what Alan said a little bit, is a lot of people like the machismo, to steal a phrase, of Donald Trump, right? This idea that he can take on the world. And so the idea that you juxtapose that next to Joe Biden, who is seen as kind of easygoing, carefree guy. And so this is, you know, it was important for him to address that to me. To me, it was important for him to answer those questions. And so going back to the Leslie Stahl interview, that interview was just another on top of what happened at the previous debate, not the one we just had, the previous debate. This just was another time that Trump was acting out again and working against his own self-interest. Because to me, there's two schools of Republicans, right? There's the Trump Republicans, and then there's, to me, the traditional Republicans. And the traditional Republicans don't like the 60-minute first debate Donald Trump. It's very hard for them to stomach. And they have to kind of remember, keep reminding themselves, in my opinion, that they need to get their agenda through in order to continue to supporting him. And I think you're seeing that pull away. You're seeing that pull away because they don't like this Trump. And that's why you're seeing them turn and, you know, support Joe Biden. So I think this only helps the Biden-Harris ticket. This only helps the Biden-Harris ticket. But, of course, the Trump Republicans are going to stay firm. I do think they're single.
Sienna, don't you think he has to have enemies? He doesn't want anything but enemies because he wants to see himself as the oppressed.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't, you know, I try to listen to Mary Trump and see what she has to say about her uncle to understand a little bit about him. I really do. I don't understand. I don't understand that the narcissism that she says he has. I don't understand what his strategy is. To me, he's just it can be very alienating. And it's hard for me as a rational person to understand.
But as I've said so many times, somehow, some way, he got to be president of the United States of America. You know, our dismissal of him as this unreconstructed narcissist, it's true. But whatever it is, he harnessed it, he made it work for him, and he's trying the same playbook now, don't you think?
I mean, you have to remember, people love to watch Trump on The Apprentice. I mean, I remember watching, he has a compelling personality. I would go so far as to say he may even be called charismatic, right? When you have Trump one-on-one, you're talking to him one-on-one, he's not as offensive one-on-one as he is as he comes off as a 60-minute interview. And so I think that Trump is what won the 2016 election, that and a whole bunch of other things, such as people not going out to vote and, you know, but I think that Trump is what won. That personality is what won the 2016 election. But now we see what happens when that, you know, because I think everybody thought that Trump would surround himself with smart people and he would, you know, get the job done. What we see happen, it never happened. And so I think this is going to be a different turnout.
I mean, to your point, Alan, of yes, he's president of the United States. When Joe Biden said that last night in the 60 Minutes interview, he said, you know, he still very much could win this. And I think that's not just a politician being careful. I think it's true. It's absolutely true, and he knows it. One of the things over the weekend that we heard is that the White House wants to move to have the Supreme Court rehear the case regarding the Pennsylvania ballots, assuming that state is closer than it seems to be now, which, as Libby indicated a little while ago, was about six to seven points. But if it is closer than that the extra 3 days that the absentee ballots are being given to be counted by the Supreme Court, that the president's plan, which he has articulated, is to have the court go back to it. By that time, you'll have Amy Coney Barrett as a justice sitting on the court, and you will not have a split. You will probably have an extra vote in your favor. Jim?
Who are you directing that to?
Jim.
I agree. I think that's part of what, you know, this push for Barrett is. I think, you know, we see a lot of craziness here. You know, I mean, again, we've just been talking all that talk about COVID and, you know, he's going to turn it around with the vaccinations and et cetera, et cetera. And meanwhile, you know, we're about to lose health care, right? I mean, it seems very unlikely that the Barrett court is going to uphold the ACA. So you're sitting here going, you know, the just contradictions and all of this stuff is just bizarre.
But isn't Biden very smart to say that Trump could win it?
Absolutely.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely. It cuts through the complacency. You know, it makes sure that his people gets out the vote. I mean, you know, that's one of the problems that we have.
Well, and it's true, right? I mean, it's true. It's true.
And isn't it wonderful to have a guy not speaking down, not telling lies, just telling it like it is?
We have a bunch of letters, and I want to get to those. We have to go to a break here in 10 minutes or so, so I'll get as many in as I can, and then we'll do more on the other side. Jeffrey writes, please explain why everybody thought it was so funny that Kamala Harris laughed in the face of the interviewer asking if she is a socialist, particularly when the panel seems to be in favor of socially progressive policy generally. If in favor of such social policy, one would think you would want a social-minded candidate. Kamala and Biden are more conservative than Trump in many cases. Look at their career record. Not 100% sure what the point of the letter is, but...
Being socially progressive in your policy views does not make you a socialist. You know what I mean? There are fiscal conservatives and social progressives, and there's a difference between socially progressive and wanting there to be health care for all and wanting there to be public education for all, and then saying that you're a socialist. It's two different things.
Alan is absolutely right. This is the final battle of the war of northern aggression. For a lot of Southerners, the war never ended. The reason for open shops in the South was to take union jobs away from the North. The tax bill was also a way to take power and money from the progressive states, which have been supporting them. I was in the Outer Banks at a used bookstore and was going through some posters of Confederate soldiers marching under the cross. They will not stop until the North is dominated by the South. We go to Tom, who says, I have a question. I was talking to a friend over the weekend who said that the majority of early voters we've seen so far are Democratic Party voters. The friend also suggested that Republican Trump voters are planning to turn out in force right on Election Day and vote for the lying liar. Can the panel discuss this a bit? I'd like to know how true this might be.
Well, it may be what Trump is trying to do. I think Election Day is going to bring out a lot of people, and I don't think he's going to win. I don't think he's going to win there either. I don't think Trump's going to win there either. But clearly, this is the new wisdom, which we keep hearing from the pundits and everybody else, you know, that the vote by mail will be overwhelming and that the early voting will be overwhelming. But on Election Day, he's going to lose. Now, if that happens, you know what you're going to hear from Donald Trump, that all the other stuff is bogus.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And we're going to see 100 court cases, and they're going to show up in his new court.
Luis says Trump and Pence's rally.
Hey, Joe, can I go back to that? Okay. So now we have Putin this morning sounding like a Biden fan. A Biden fan. You know, pretty smart guy. He may be evil, but he's smart, and he sees what's coming. And he sees what's coming. He says, "Uh-oh, I better do something here." You know, Hunter Biden didn't do anything wrong, and I know it, and I'm telling everybody that, so that when Biden wins, he'll be able to be there and say, "You owe me, buddy." But I don't think he owes him, or he controls him like he controls the other guy. Now, I know I started to talk here when I had an idea, but I don't have it anymore.
It was about the Supreme Court and about the judges.
Yes. Thank you for that. Thank you for that, Joe.
And here we go.
You know, she is no fool. And she says that Barrett, and she says that she will obey the law and she'll go with the law. And we have John Roberts, who clearly doesn't want to give up the reputation of the court. Nor does he want another two judges added. Nor does he want to see the Congress of the United States changing the original jurisdiction, the jurisdiction of the court, which it has many abilities to do. You know, there's some stuff that have to go to the court, but for the most part, the Congress has a lot of power. These people don't want to give it up. So unless they're, why would they throw themselves on their swords? And John Roberts hasn't, and I have a feeling he's going to have a lot of sway with her.
I agree with you. I do not. I've said this all along. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Sienna.
Oh, I was just going to say I agree. I think Neil Gorsuch is also someone that is going to want to preserve the integrity of the court. I was agreeing with Alan. I think that we will be surprised, hopefully, about some of the outcomes of these court decisions.
And in fact, if you look at the senators right now, right? If you look at the senators right now, the Republicans, yeah, they're going to go along with this confirmation. They really have to. But they are distancing themselves now. They say, okay, you can drown, but don't bring me with you. And I have a feeling the court's going to feel some of that, too. I'm sorry for going on too long.
And then we'll talk about Lisa Murkowski's very fragile spine shattering over the weekend.
I've said all along that John Roberts wants this to be known as the Roberts Court, not the Trump Court. And he will make sure that that's the case.
I don't know how he makes sure. You know, we don't know what happened.
But based on what you just said, Alan, based on what you just said, that he's going to be making sure that the cases are done correctly and not politically.
Woodrow Wilson once said, secret deals, no secret deals secretly arrived at. We do not know what went into that nomination.
No,
that's
no.
all I'm going to say.
No.
Jim?
Yeah, all I can say is, you know, Bush-Gore, you know, the court sort of suddenly law didn't have quite as much meaning as it did the day before. And, you know, she's replacing Scalia, and is a Scalia disciple, and boy, I sure didn't see him vote with Roberts a lot in these kind of cases. So I don't know. I hope I pray you're right, Alan, but you know, I've already kissed Roe versus Wade goodbye. I'm already kissing a lot of other things goodbye, and we'll see what happens with this.
Let's go to Robert's question, which is appropriate to what we're talking about right now. I keep hearing on how that even if Biden were to win by 6 points or more, he might still lose in the Electoral College. If this is the case, what's the point of voting? Where is my hope, panel?
That is a very bad letter.
Exactly.
Well, it's a very good letter that is very concerning, right?
No. I'll tell you what's wrong with it. Obviously, and we love the letter and the concern which we all have. But it's but what's so scary is they, well, maybe I better, because the implication is maybe I better stay home and not go and
vote.
Every single vote is going to count in this election. I'll tell you right now.
Well, and I think it's even going to count in states like, you know, New York, Massachusetts, which are so likely to go blue. I think, you know, again, the overall numbers are going to have some impact on that thinking. You know, people will be looking at the electoral vote, but if it's unclear, but Biden has a huge, you know, electoral lead, a huge popular lead, I think that's going to help. So, you know, fingers crossed, you know, who knows what's going to happen in either direction. That's not an endorsement by the radio station. But,
okay. No, but what happens if, and I asked the governor this the other day, what happens if Trump goes to the Supreme Court in, I'm talking the prostitution model now, goes to the Supreme Court and says to them, please eliminate all fraudulent online voting or all fraudulent advance voting or mail voting. And the Supreme Court says 6-3 that you're right. We have to do that. We have to do that. Now, when you get that, you're into totalitarianism. You're in. That's the end of democracy as we know it. And you're assuming that these people on the court have some guts and some spine. But I don't know. They know who put them there.
Well, but it also comes up one case at a time. It's not like he says, so, you know, you're going to have rule on this, rule on this, rule on this. And so a fairly narrow set of rulings could still look reasonable but change the election.
I think I want to note something.
Sienna?
I think it's important. I think it's important to note that she's like Scalia in so much that she's an originalist, you know, interpreting the Constitution according to what it was meant when it was adopted. But she goes a little further. I mean, a little bit, because she's also a textualist, which means that she interprets the plain words of a legal statute, which may be helpful when it comes to interpreting the voting rights and what's the state's voting rights and what they have to say. She goes by the plain words rather than the lawmaker's intent. And so I think that might be a little more helpful when we come up with these voting cases that may come after the election. I am just shooting hope out there.
We'll take all the hopeful rays we can get. We got to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue. We'll hear more from Santa on that, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Last go around with our panel this morning: Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Jim Hendler, and Sienna Freeman Tolbert. Quick programming note: we will be hearing from New York Governor Andrew Cuomo at 11:30 this morning. He has a briefing from Albany and the Red Room, and we will be going to that as soon as it begins, somewhere right around 11:30 this morning. Also, we only have a few moments left with our panel, so we want to get letters in. We welcome yours, panel@wamc.org. So, Sienna, you were talking just before the break, before we had to go over to BBC, about the about Justice Barrett and, well, Judge Barrett, soon to be, we think, Justice Barrett, that of the pattern, the thought, and that is an optimistic way, at least in these particular cases, right? I mean, it will change down the line, we assume.
Exactly. It will change. What I was saying is that, you know, basically she subscribes to the thought that, you know, you shouldn't rewrite laws. The court's job is not to rewrite laws. Their job is to just, you know, interpret the plain reading of it. And, you know, as someone that has been surprised over the past 2 years of some of the stances that Justice Roberts has taken, you know, I'm trying to be optimistic, and we're really just were analyzing and just kind of reading about her and trying to guess what she will do. But that is one little silver lining, is that she is a textualist, with the idea being that what she's going to do is interpret the plain meaning of these state voting laws, rather than try to update them or kind of, you know, interpret them in any other way. We're looking at lawmakers' intent as well. So that's hopeful.
We'll take the hope wherever we can get it. Let's see. We've got some letters. Carolyn writes, my question is, if it's okay for Norah O'Donnell to ask Kamala Harris if she is a socialist, is it okay to ask Donald Trump if he's a Nazi? Thank you for all you do, panel. Dolly says, there are those that thrive on chaos. Trump labeling those people as victims justifies their use of chaos as a perceived defense tactic. A Trump presidency is a gift to them. Louise says, Trump and Pence's rallies are Trump, Pence, and the Republicans' way of promoting herd immunity. The rallies also remind me of a cult where the members are willing to give up their lives for their quote-unquote leader. Eric says, analogies to the Civil War are apt, but I'm reminded of the Blitz in World War II. Before the Allies were ready to launch the D-Day invasion, people huddled in the underground to avoid being killed by German bombs. Similarly, we need to wear masks and to distance while we wait for an effective vaccine to be developed and distributed. We shouldn't go wandering out without protection, just as the people of London sheltered until they could effectively neutralize the menace.
Well, how stupid can people be? I mean, we know the evidence. We have seen it in New York State. The governor keeps bragging, and he's right to do it, that we have done the right thing. It was below 1%. Now it's slightly above 1%. You got states where it's many, many times that. And yet those folks who adore this president go to his rallies, risk death, and do it. I mean, for the life of me, nobody can be that stupid.
Anybody else? We go to R. Jeremy, who says, dear panel, Trump is a coward if he loses convincingly. Oh, I just deleted it. Darn it. My finger just went on the button a little too fast. I'll try to find that note because there was an Anthony Scaramucci reference. Let's see. Tom says, the only undecideds left are Democrats who might not vote for a variety of the usual Democratic issues, such as apathy plus COVID, intimidations, etc. The Trump's deplorables are solid in their delusion.
There may be something else here. There still may be some Bernieites out there. I mean, Bernie is doing what he can right now. But there are people who are writing to us and saying Joe Biden isn't progressive enough and Kamala Harris isn't progressive enough, you know, and they're worse than Trump. They've talked themselves into it. Now, if you get 1% or something like that, feeling that, that could be the end. It was last time. Jill Stein got an awful lot of votes.
And they're the idiots. Yep. They're the idiots in this equation. I'm sorry. I'm sure people are going to get pissed with me, but they are. I mean, the stake of our democracy. I mean, our democracy is at stake here. The future of our democracy is at stake. And they're, you know, wanting to argue about the crumbs of the pie. It's just absurd.
Yep.
Well, I'm sure people are going to write.
Well, you know, Libby, back in the beginnings of the Soviet Union, when there were, you know, there was a lot of self deception going on, and look what they got. A lot of them murdered. You know, I think that's what's happening here too. People can be very stupid.
Yes.
So the letter I was reading, Trump is a coward. If he loses convincingly, he'll whine away. He does not have the courage to confront the majority of Americans to try to govern in that reality. Me and Anthony Scaramucci agree on this. We go to Joseph, who says, so far I have had my Biden flag ripped down and my Black Lives Matter lawn sign painted over with a swastika. Everyone that drives by gives the house the finger, whether I'm outside or not. I'm afraid to tell you where I'm located. I mean, the sad thing is you could be located probably in any part of our region.
Mm-hmm.
Ed says, as most public attention understandably focuses on upcoming elections and the pandemic, America today will quietly take one giant step toward authoritarianism. The Republican Senate's lockstep confirmation of ultra-conservative Amy Coney Barrett as Supreme Court Justice will be seen in history as a dramatic milestone in the process of the late, great United States existing in the community of healthy, functioning democracies. Sienna, anything on that?
What I'm most concerned about, I think, for me with this confirmation hearing is not so much, her being confirmed. For me, it's the breakdown in the Senate. I mean, I've never seen so much, tension, and I'm just really concerned about that. But I think we can recover with the court. I think we can recover. I don't see it as dismal as everyone else sees it. But I was more concerned about the tension in the Senate and whether or not they can come back from this and work together.
Great point.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. It has removed civility from a lot of things. And I think, if the Democrats take it, it's going to be almost impossible for them not to get rid of the filibuster rule, at which point it's like we've thrown out some of the reason for having a Senate as a break on Congress and things like that. But we already did that in the judges, and it's bad.
Deborah writes to us and says, even though Trump will have nominated three justices, should they rule to disqualify early and mail-in ballots just because he wants them to? That's a question mark. Wouldn't a Biden victory mean Trump has no power over them? I've said it 1,000 times. I'll say it one more time. Should schmud. And Joe, of course, always says it's good to have hope.
Yeah. Otherwise, I just get tired of sleeping with my head in the oven. It didn't stop
the Senate. Every single one of those Republicans, minus the sort of pathetic Susan Collins, from voting with them to confirm.
Yep.
Exactly. Where were they?
Right. And
look, this all comes down to getting rid of overturning Roe v. Wade. That's what this comes down to. It comes down to protecting corporations, and it comes down to possibly overturning marriage equality. That's what this comes down to for these folks. It has, I really don't think it has much to do with Trump. I think it has to do with these policy issues that they want to make sure are enshrined in our country for the next 100 years.
Mike says the virus death toll this morning is at 226,000. I just wonder, if Donald had taken the virus seriously, how many of those 226,000 might have voted for him? He'll never know. The only thing Donald hasn't done to combat the virus is the Dorothy method. Click your heels together three times and repeat, the virus is going away.
Let's not insult Dorothy that way.
Robert says Trump is getting his backers sick. It's like they want to get the virus to prove how loyal they are. Have they voted yet? Question mark. We also go to Christine. I'm a nurse, and every day I get several emails from traveling nurse agencies offering huge signing bonuses for assignments at hospitals in the Midwest. Who's paying for this? I'm baffled as to why this immense cost hasn't been reported as another huge drain on our hospital and insurance company costs. Interesting point.
Yeah.
Let's quickly go. We were talking about Putin earlier, and we just have about 3 or 4 minutes. And the headline in the Washington Post, tumult at home, ailing alliances abroad, why Trump's America has been a quote-unquote gift to Putin. The 45th president won in a looking back at the presidency. Under President Trump, the Washington Post writes, Philip Rucker and Shane Harris, the U.S. has abandoned international climate and nuclear arms agreements. It has announced its withdrawal from the World Health Organization, questioned the future of North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and antagonized stalwarts and allies like Germany. America's past presidents have long promoted democracy, human rights, and the rule of law abroad, yet Trump instead has waged an assault on those values at home, where he has weakened institutions, shredded norms, and declared without evidence that the upcoming election will be rigged. America's moral authority has also been undercut by the devastatingly high death toll and the wrenching economic fallout from the coronavirus pandemic. These highlights from Trump's nearly 4 years in office read like Vladimir Putin's wish list. Few countries have benefited more geopolitically from Trump's time in office than Russia. Alan.
Well, you know, that's true, except for one thing. There's still Russia, and this is still the United States. It isn't that I'm going to go rah-rah for the country, but, you know, he's got a pathetic bunch of people there that are committed to authoritarianism and always have been and probably always will be. So I don't see him as being, you know, sure, he's gained some prestige and he's gained some power as a result of this, but nothing like winning a war.
Hmm. We have a minute. Anybody?
So I would,
go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I would actually disagree with whether Putin is the one who's actually, got the most benefit out of it. Because, boy, you look geopolitically, China has just won big out of Trump's policies. We have become the thing that has turned China into a competitive superpower economically in Asia, and I think there's almost no way we can win that back.
And let's not forget Trump's recently discovered bank account in China. Things are not always what they seem.
Yep.
Not at all. Well, I want to thank everybody for being with us and for joining us this morning. We greatly appreciate it. Thanks to everybody who wrote in. Thanks to Dr. Jim Fagan for joining us early on. Alan, thank you very much. Thanks also to Libby Post, Jim Henler, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert. You're all wonderful. We will be back with the Congressional Corner right after this short break.